Welcome back to another edition of Why Football Happens as we continue our Euro 2020 coverage and we get a chance to look at two of the big guns in the tournament. Belgium had an emphatic victory over Russia on Saturday night before England on Sunday afternoon got their first win of the competition, a victory at Wembley Stadium over Croatia. Delighted to say that on the podcast today, Stephen Drennan and Ben Jacobs breaking down all the action from two of the favourites of this tournament. Let's see how they got on. Enjoy the podcast.
In what did you make of England's 1-0 victory over Croatia at a very hot Wembley Stadium?
I thought you have to applaud England. They beat the team that was in front of them. They had some problems in the first half. I was impressed with how they adjusted second half to take care of a few things. The thing for me was the negativity before the match when the team sheet came out. There was quite a lot of surprises on there. Things like Sancho and Grealish not being involved, having two really top quality left backs, probably two of the best left backs actually in the world at the moment, and then picking Kieran Trippier at left back. So, yeah, it was a bit strange before the match because all the focus was on all of the things that were wrong with the team sheet. But they done a really professional job. I was impressed.
I thought the first 10 or 15 minutes of both halves, England were very strong. Their link-up play, their movement, Calvin Phillips and Sterling in that first 15 minutes were really impressive. But of course, they didn't get the goal. And then early on in the second half, they got the breakthrough and it proved to be enough. Who specifically stood out for you? For me, Calvin Phillips was man of the match.
Yeah, same. In the first half in particular, he really stood out. Particularly in those first 30 minutes for England, he just seemed to be absolutely everywhere. He was a number six, who was also a number 10. It was crazy. And I think it's interesting because when you were coming into the tournament, you're probably thinking of Henderson plus Rice or... And Calvin Phillips was sort of a name on the periphery, as in if either of the first choices were to get injured, maybe he would come in. I think he's just nailed down a starting spot. I don't think you can leave him out now. You can't after that performance. It was wonderful.
When you look at the system that England might play, and I suppose there is a lot of versatility, there is options depending on opposition and circumstances within games. But I think one thing most people would predict is that Harry Kane will be the first name on the team sheet, but he wasn't overly involved. And then when he had a chance to kill off the game, despite a little bit of defensive pressure, he wasn't able to finish it. And I think that goes down as a big miss rather than just good defending. Is he right to be deemed as an automatic selection, and is he the right fit for England's system?
Yeah, Harry Kane is just such a weird one today because I tweeted out at halftime that he had completed 5 passes, had 0 shots, had lost the ball, had been caught on the ball twice, had been offside once, and basically was just absolutely on the periphery of the game. Just wasn't involved at all. But the worst thing isn't so much what he did with the ball, it's what he was doing without it. He was basically staying between the posts, and which is kind of like most of your number nines, your target men, that's kind of what they do. They stay between the ghosts and posts and try and sniff out a goal, like your Lewandowski's, your Lukaku's, etc. But the problem was is that when you pick Raheem Sterling on the left, cutting in on his right, and Foden on the right, cutting in on his left, you're wanting them to exploit the space in the middle in the same way as Liverpool do with Mane on the left, Salah on the right. You're wanting your nine to vacate the space, move the centre-backs around and have those players attacking it. And he just didn't do that at all. And I made that comment at the end of the first half that if he does that, then maybe England will get in. And ironically, it was exactly what happened for the goal. The ball came down the right. He moved over onto the right, created a huge space in the middle, and Sterling got played in by the brilliant Phillips again. And it was just such an easy goal to score. And it was just that little bit of movement. It was nothing to do with what he did on the ball. It was just moving the centre-backs around, and he wasn't doing it first half. And the problem I had, I guess, with the whole England performance is that they won in spite of the system rather than because of it. Like, their fullbacks offered no width at all. Trippier as a right-footed left-back isn't going to provide any width. The only chance he created in the game is from a throw-in. Kyle Walker on the right barely got past the halfway line. When he did, his passing was just really off. And it was more the individual brilliance of players that was making things happen rather than the system creating chances, or from pressing they were creating chances, but the system wasn't doing anything to help. And so Harry Kane had absolutely no service. If you've no width, you've no service for a player like Harry Kane. And it just seems like the whole thing's kind of set up to fail, I guess. But Croatia isn't the team that it's going to fail against. If you line up with that team against a better side, like against France or a Netherlands, or Spain or Portugal, you're going to have a lot more problems, because they're able to stop players like Foden and Sterling much better than Croatia did today.
Well, that's one thing I was going to ask you. Normally, game one of a major tournament against, on paper, probably the strongest other team in our group. I know Croatia aren't quite what they were if you compare them to the last World Cup or even back in Euro 96, but nonetheless, on paper, probably stronger than Scotland, with all due respect, definitely stronger than the Czech Republic. So therefore, is this just a starting lineup and a style and a way of playing to combat Croatia? Or, as with most teams, is this an indication that it's essentially relatively close to Gareth Southgate's preferred 11, minus maybe Maguire, who of course is injured? And if that's the case, do you think that's why a lot of England fans were worried in the build-up to the game when they saw the team sheet? Because there is that feeling that, you know, everything goes according to plan. You beat Scotland next up, you're probably going to win the group. And then you've got an absolutely horrific draw in the first round of the knockout stage. And then is it likely to be same style, same 11? Or do you actually sense that this might have been an 11 specifically tailored towards beating Croatia?
Yeah, I mean, it could be either. And the thing is we can never actually go into a manager's head and tell, rather, unless he actually comes out and says. What I would say is that there was lots of little things in the game that the England staff took care of. Things like putting on Bellingham and thicking up midfield and bringing on Rashford whenever there was going to be pace to counter. But also that thing I said at halftime about just getting Harry Kane to vacate the posts occasionally and create some space. Phil Foden started moving around a bit at the start of the second half, which basically gave England some overloads that they didn't have in the first half. So there was lots of little things, little changes and adjustments that England made that were good for me, because it shows that they have some game management and they're able to pay attention to little details that can help you. In terms of the lineup, it's really hard to say, because the thing I would say now is that England have essentially through to the next round. Whether it's top in the group or second or third, it doesn't really matter, that they're going to go through to the knockout stages. And that kind of gives them two games against easier opposition to basically rest players and also to try different things. And if he puts in players like Grealish and Sancho or makes changes at fullback and Shaw plays the way he did last season, he could stumble upon things that work better for him. And then it would look like that was the intention all along. Like, this was just a game to get out of against Croatia. But his plan all along was to do this. And it might very well be, or it might just be that he stumbled on something different. My worry would be if they were to line up against this, like this against other teams, I think they would struggle. So it'll be interesting to see what they do in the rest of the group games. But when they get to the knockout games, assuming they finish first, they're probably going to play Portugal or France or Germany. So yeah, I think they'd need something different.
It's only one game, obviously, and you don't always see a flurry of goals in opening games. And I think it's only Belgium so far in the tournament that have even scored in the first half. But if we are to compare so far against, in inverted commas, contenders, we've seen Italy against stubborn opposition in the first half, got their goal, floodgates opened. We've seen Belgium, again, got their first goal, floodgates opened. And then we've seen England in relatively tricky conditions against quite a deep defensive experienced team. But nonetheless, we've seen England take the lead and then miss a couple of clear-cut chances. How much of a concern will that be to Gareth Southgate? Obviously, it's a win. Obviously, it's a clean sheet. And yes, Croatia are a very organised side. But even in a knockout tournament where the points are more important than, say, how many goals you scored, that ability to kill off the game, and perhaps we've seen it in some of the warm-up matches for England as well, I think might just nag at the back of the squad's mind. And it sort of reminded me when Kane missed that relative sitter of, again, the World Cup semi against Croatia, when Kane also missed a sitter. And of course, on that occasion, England got punished, Croatia fought back, and they ended up winning the game. And the last thing we want is all of this potential, all these fast starts, all this versatility, all of this talent, great width, great movement, great finishes, but to only get one goal, because at some point across a whole tournament, England would be punished for that.
Yeah, I mean, that is ultimately what it comes down to. It's kind of really hard again, because the thing about width is if you have a right footer on the left, you essentially can't do anything quickly down that side, because Sterling's naturally wanting to come inside. And Mason Mount, I noticed, basically played the match as almost like a second left-sided attacking midfielder. He was a lot more left than central. It was him and Sterling making everything happen. And so the chances they did create, it didn't really come from width, and Croatia weren't really sitting in a block, and you can't really stretch a team unless you have good width on both sides. Again, if you look at pretty much every Premier League team that sort of did well last season, they all have a very good left back who's very good at attacking the space down the side and getting the ball into the box. And you kind of need that. And so I think Kane didn't really have any good service, and to have like one chance and miss it, it's basically just like, it's a variance thing, I guess. If he gets like three chances like that in a game, he's going to score two. And it's just that the fact that he missed one, we maybe shouldn't put too big a focus on it. But the other thing I would say is we also have to bear in mind, he was a teammate of Christian Eriksen for pretty much his whole professional career. So maybe I imagine that if it was me, I probably wouldn't have slept very well last night. And we also have to look at players in the human side of things. Maybe he did have a rough night. Maybe he wasn't on top of his game today. He certainly didn't look like the Harry Kane that we saw last season. So I'd be inclined to sort of give him a break. But yeah, the concern would be that if you create chances like this in this level, you have to finish them. You have to be more clinical, particularly against a better team than Croatia. And the other thing is, they didn't really create many big chances. Yeah, again, against a stronger team, they're probably going to need something different. I still think Grealish is the key to this England team. He's the one thing that's sort of something different, and just he just creates things out of nothing. And I'd like to see him more involved, hopefully, in the next two group games.
Yeah, I'm sure that Grealish will start against Scotland, or if he doesn't start, feature heavily. When you look at who was left out, there's 23 you can have in the squad, 26 in total for England. Maguire's injured, and then the two that missed out, even though they were fit, Ben Chilwell, Champions League winner, and Jadon Sancho. Chilwell, I can understand, because when you've got so many fullbacks, one of them is probably always going to not make the cut, although he's a very versatile player who can also push and play in midfield, but there's lots of options there as well. But Sancho continues to baffle me, because to me, that sets a tone that he's not an integral member of this England squad. He'll naturally come back, I would have thought, into the squad for Scotland, because there's probably a plan. I don't think any fit player just won't be on the bench at all for two consecutive games. But when you've got a player of his potential and of his talent, it almost falls into that Grealish argument of being underutilized. And I just don't think that Gareth Southgate sees him as big a weapon as a lot of people that have watched him maybe week in, week out would. Do you think that he is an important squad player for England as the tournament goes on? Or do you fear that he's just going to end up being a bit part player throughout this entire tournament that gets very few minutes?
Yeah, I actually joked about this on Twitter before the England team was announced, the squad was announced, that I get the feeling sometimes that there's certain people that release things to the media just to see how the reaction is to it and to see whether or not they should change their mind. And I kind of felt a bit like that with Trent Alexander-Arnold. There's loads of, oh, he's going to be left out of the squad. And then an extended squad is named with Trent Alexander in it. And then when he gets injured, it basically takes the job out of Southgate's hands to actually include him or not. And it always felt a bit similar with Sancho, like, maybe he isn't the type of player that Southgate sort of rates or sees a value for in his team. It feels like he's included him in the squad as a token gesture to the people who were up in arms about the fact that he wasn't going to be included, and to leave him out entirely is just, it's strange. Like you can't really argue against starting with Sterling, Mount and Foden. It's they're all good players, and it's a case of picking three from five, I guess. But to just not have him on the bench at all is just a bit, it's just a bit strange. I just didn't understand it. Maybe it's the idea that if he's going to bring players on, he would bring on Grealish and Rashford, and so he didn't really see a value to including him, but just didn't make any sense to me. He's a potential game changer. If you're in trouble in the game, you want to bring him on. It also could just be the case that he's maybe not focused on the game as much as others. Maybe the talk, constant talk in the media of this Manchester United move, maybe that's in his head quite a bit. And maybe Southgate basically just thinks he needs to be kept away from the squad at the moment because he's not 100% on the game. You don't want to speculate, but there's lots of things happening at the same time, so you don't know what the actual cause is. It is really weird not to include him, though. For me, his numbers, in terms of like a young winger, there's not many young wingers I've ever seen that have his output already. It's usually something that players find later in their career. Even if you go back to like the John Barnes era of footballers, like his output wasn't high when he broke through. So for Sancho to be doing this at such a young age, it's impressive, and you kind of want to include him as early as you can and get him into the squad and basically see what he can do at international level. So it's a shame that he's not involved. It's the problem, though, when you're having to pick, like, basically from a very good core of players, there are going to be someone that misses out. Today it's Sancho, but maybe next time he'll be involved.
A quick word on Croatia. From what you've seen today, and in the build-up, do you still think that they're the second-best team in the group? Because now, suddenly, Scotland-Czech Republic is a huge game, and the Scots, knowing they've got England next and being confident that on paper they can get something from the Czech Republic, if not all 3 points. And looking at Croatia today, I think, and seeing that they look quite disorganised at times and they didn't react well to England's high press and energy, I think if you're Scotland, you're thinking, wow, if we beat the Czech Republic now, not only are we going to go through because of how the tournament format is, but we would be massive favourites at that point to finish second in the group. And, you know, second in the group for Scotland is better than first in the group because of how the draw actually transpires.
Yeah, the thing I would say is that maybe today's game is the first game we've saw where it's two highly rated teams playing each other, two teams that are considered as maybe being able to do something in this tournament, that are facing each other. So it's maybe not a good game to draw any conclusions against. This is the sort of game, I think, where it's just about matchups on the day, and whichever team manages to impose their will on the other will come out on top and the other team will look poor. And we see these big games all over the place. Like if you remember at the start of the season, Manchester United v Spurs, and Manchester United got torn to pieces. And if you draw conclusions on that game, you wouldn't predict that United finished second in the league and Spurs end up whimpering over the finish line and sacking their manager halfway through. So I don't like making big conclusions based on like one game between two big sides early on, but they seem to have lots of problems in terms of their team. Like basically they have a really strong core group of midfielders and then they don't really have much else. And a lot of the other key players are sort of aging now. Perisic is obviously in the wrong age, and as a forward, his impact's going to diminish as he gets older. They also have Kramaric, who I really like at a club level, but he hasn't really seemed to translate that into international football as well. Rebic is really good at Milan, but didn't really have any impact on the game today. And when he did get one chance, he just completely fluffed it and screwed it wide. So, yeah, it's hard to say how their tournament will go. I think they'll get out of the group okay. I think they'll probably finish second in the group. I just don't see them having anywhere near the impact they did in the World Cup. I think their moment's gone, I guess, and they need to wait for the next golden generation to come through.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they fare. And as you say, they can be quite confident of getting out of the group. And we've said it many times in the build-up and in podcasts that
4 points is almost certainly going to be enough for anybody to get out of their group because of how the structure of this particular tournament works. So they'll be looking at Scotland and the Czech Republic and feeling like they can win both of those games. So England beating Croatia by a goal to nil, Raheem Sterling with his first goal at a major tournament, and England have got a great record when Raheem Sterling has scored. I think that's now played 10, won 10 in terms of friendlies and international tournaments when he's been on the score sheet for England. So basically, when Sterling scores, England tend to get the result that they're looking for. But we've seen more convincing victories so far from Italy in the opening game over Turkey, who I think was your dark horse, Stephen. And last night, Belgium beating Russia by 3-0. So let's talk a little bit about that game because we haven't touched upon it. I should just point out that the big story, of course, yesterday was around Christian Eriksen. And we did a special podcast late last night that you can listen to where we went into that in a lot of depth. So we won't touch upon that too much. But if you want to listen more, you can tune into our previous podcast. But we, of course, are delighted that Christian is stable and awake, and we wish him well. And Finland went on to win that restarted game by 1-0. We might just touch upon why that game was restarted and if it was the right call, Stephen. But I want to talk about the Belgium victory first, because we didn't get to chat about that yesterday. What did you make of that 3-0 win over a relatively poor Russia side?
Yeah, it's I kind of expected it. I remember we said in the podcast when we were previewing this that I didn't see Russia doing anything. I thought in the World Cup they were basically carried by the fact that they were playing it in Russia and as tournament hosts. I think we saw that with Korea as well in their World Cup. That as hosts you sort of get carried through it a bit on the adrenaline and the fact that it's being held in your country. But I never thought Russia were a good side. And a lot of their key players are a bit older now. And so, yeah, I figured they were going to struggle. The thing for me in the Belgian game I thought was very interesting was the first goal, because I think that should be offside. I know by the law why it isn't offside, but I feel like that should be offside. If you've ever played as a centre-back, and there's a forward behind you, and you don't know if he's onside or offside, and you can't take that risk. So you have to play the ball. But if Lukaku isn't there, it's much easier to play the ball because you're not actually even thinking about him. So you can just focus on one job. And the second thing is, if Lukaku isn't there, the keeper can just come out and gather that, and it's an easy ball. So it's basically Lukaku being there, absolutely miles offside, makes the defence make a mistake. And that just feels wrong to me, because then he is interfering with play and he is offside. And so it should be an offside, in my opinion. And so that was the only thing that bugged me about that first goal. Like, it's a wonderful story, of course, the celebration, saying I love you, Christian, and that's great. But just from a purely analytical point of view, the goal really annoyed me, because I don't like those sorts of goals. It reminds me of the one, actually, Ruud van Nistelrooy scored for Netherlands absolutely years ago in the Euros. And he was like 30 yards offside when an attack started. And the ball sort of got down the left and cut back to him, and at no point was he onside. But because the ball's cut back to him, the goal is onside, and it was like there's a big uproar over it, whether or not that should be an offside, whether he should be allowed to participate in that attack at all, because he started offside and never got onside. And it feels a bit like that with Lukaku. I know why it's onside, I just don't think it should be.
I agree with you. It's one of those, again, about the phase of play versus the letter of the law. But overall, Belgium did really well, I thought, just to silence the home crowd. I mean, everyone has often spoken about these big teams that have got home advantage. Luka Modric said that it was unfair that England had home advantage at Wembley Stadium, but Belgium had to go in front of a 30-odd thousand crowd in St. Petersburg, and it was just a really professional performance. And you alluded to the fact that Russia, not the same side as when they hosted the World Cup, but you still expect that kind of buzz on home soil, kicking off a tournament. And they were really flat. Belgium just continued what they did in qualifying. They scored 40 goals in qualifying, which I think was more than any other side. And you alluded to earlier, Kane, and you could add Sterling to this bracket, not stepping up to international football with quite the same momentum of the season that's just passed. And then you compare that to somebody like Lukaku, who scored 24 goals and won Serie A with Inter and already on the score sheet now at Euro 2020. He might be a contender for the Golden Boot if Belgium obviously get into the latter stages of the tournament, as many expect. I'm still putting my money on Benzema, incidentally, but Lukaku is going to be right up there. My only concern, though, for Belgium, Stephen, is all these little injuries they've picked up. I know it was good, for example, to see Eden Hazard come off the bench, but they've already got Kevin De Bruyne, who's nursing that fractured nose and eye socket, and then Timothy Castagne went up with another horrible injury, which I believe was a fractured eye socket as well. How big a miss could those two players be? I mean, we know De Bruyne is a miss. It's common sense just to say so. Castagne, I think, is underrated. I would say this because I'm a Leicester fan, and on his day for us, he was a huge weapon coming down the wing as fullback. He was probably, if you rank it, most effective for Atalanta, secondary effective for Leicester, third effective for Belgium in terms of his influence because of their array of stars. But do you think Castagne will be missed at international level?
Yeah, I really like Castagne. He's a very good player. I watched quite a lot of Atalanta maybe a season or so ago. This season, I haven't watched too much, but I remember him being a very important player to them. They use their fullbacks a lot. They're absolutely crucial to everything they do. And I thought for Leicester, Pereira was always one of your best players, and rightly rated as highly as he was. And I thought it would be really hard just to replace him. But he's actually come in and done a fantastic job of replacing him, and even switches over to the left, and even as a right-footed left back, he's a good player as well. The De Bruyne thing was really interesting too, because I remember the World Cup in 2002 for France, and I was worried that it would be a similar thing for Belgium, where they're relying on their star player De Bruyne, but he's injured. And the whole thing is about getting him in, getting him back into the team. And if they had a bad result against Russia, do they sort of start rushing him back into the team? And he's not ready, and he doesn't look ready. And because that's what happened with France in 2002. But now that they've won against Russia, I guess all the pressure's off. They just need a point to get through their group. But I was kind of worried about that. And even just ongoing, I don't know what De Bruyne will be like when he comes back. I think playing with fractured bones in your face probably isn't easy. I've never had to do it. It just feels like an unnecessary risk, I guess. Again, he's probably someone else you'd ideally want to leave out, but you can't because he's too good. Hazard coming back takes a lot of the pressure off, but Hazard's had one of those last 2 years. It's basically every time he gets fit, he gets injured. So it'll be a concern, I guess, to maybe wrap him in bubble wrap and use him when you need him. But again, he's arguably one of Belgium's best players, so you kind of need him on the pitch. And it's really difficult. Belgium are in that difficult position of having their two best players both struggling with injury. And then I don't know what you do about that. You probably want to try and take it easy for the rest of the group games and use them sparingly. Or you maybe try and use them and see how fit and how ready they are to be involved in a big knockout game. It's a tough call for Roberto Martinez.
Russia are back in Group B action, still in St. Petersburg on Wednesday. They take on Finland, who got that surprise victory against Denmark with their only shot on target in the game. Belgium head to Copenhagen to play Denmark on Thursday. That's obviously going to be very emotional. It's good news as far as Christian Eriksen is concerned. He's making the right progress. Hopefully he's out of hospital soon. But it was clear, wasn't it, despite the official line put out there, that Eriksen had spoken to his teammates, that both sets of players wanted to finish the game. It was clear that the Denmark team were not in the right frame of mind, and they still might not be in the right frame of mind on Thursday when they play Belgium. And if that's the case, it's going to be a difficult tournament. Of course, football doesn't really matter now. How they fare in this tournament isn't the priority. But if we are talking about this in football terms, then Denmark needs something against Belgium. Otherwise, they could well be out of the tournament.
Yeah, it's a really difficult place for Belgium. Obviously, the injuries are very different. But I remember, because I was living in Brazil at the time, when Neymar broke his back in the World Cup, and basically their team absolutely collapsed after it when they faced Germany. And there was a big psychological thing, because they basically pinned all their hopes on Neymar, and the players done the whole wearing shirts with Neymar and basically making the whole thing about Neymar. And they just psychologically collapsed against Germany. And obviously Denmark, completely different circumstances, but I think psychologically it's very hard to switch on and off real life when things like that happen. And so I don't think the Denmark players will probably sleep very well. I think their coach even said that whenever he was given the choice between playing the match the same day or kicking off at noon the next day, he basically said, I don't think the players are going to get the sleep, get up the next morning nice and early and then get on a bus and come here and do this again. So we'll just play it now. I think Denmark are just in a really bad position, and they could galvanize from it and take motivation from it and put up a big performance. But ultimately, I think football's just taken a back seat, probably in their minds. It isn't important anymore. And all they care about is Ericsson's well-being. And psychologically, I don't think you just get over something like that very quickly in a major tournament. I think it lingers, and they'll probably go out, and I don't think they care. I don't think it's really important to them at the moment.
No, and I think the only bittersweet positive within the situation where they find themselves is that they're in Copenhagen. And from a life point of view and a solidarity point of view and a family point of view, these players can go and hug their wives and partners. They can see their family probably far more in this pandemic era than if they found themselves in a fixed host location that wasn't Denmark. So they can have a bit of downtime. They can maybe return to their homes, or certainly the training camp, which is just a little bit more comfortable to them than, as I say, being in a foreign country that you're not used to. And they can sort of re-galvanize. And then when they set foot in that stadium, which now is a big game for Denmark, if they are to qualify, they'll have the home support behind them. And hopefully by then, Christian will be out of hospital, and it just might spur them on to kind of refocus on the football, which of course doesn't matter if they go out. Nobody's going to criticize them. I think that the Danish papers basically went with a headline after the loss to Finland of football lost life won, which is exactly the right approach and exactly the right angle. But it is going to be difficult for them. And it's a shame in many senses, isn't it? Because although you decided that Turkey was your dark horse at the beginning, I think most people trying to find a dark horse that could go to the very business end of this tournament were saying it's either Turkey or Denmark. And my dark horse was Denmark. So there's a lot of talent there. And therefore, if they are able to focus, they are very capable on their day with that home advantage of beating Belgium. But we'll see how that one fares anyway. So it gets underway at 5 o'clock BST on Thursday. So just a reminder, England have beaten Croatia by 1-0. Yesterday, Belgium beat Russia by 3-0. Finland surprised Denmark when the match finally resumed later in the evening by 1-0. But of course, there were sad and extenuating circumstances. And we wish Christian Eriksen well with his recovery. Good to see that he's making positive progress. And the early kickoff yesterday saw Wales draw 1-1 with Switzerland, which was a good result for the Welsh. So that's it from Stephen Drennan and myself, Ben Jacobs, in the Why Football Happens podcast. We'll be doing this periodically throughout the Euros. We've got Ollie and Paul as well, and we are rotating our own squad, much like England, throughout the course of the tournament. So do stay with us. Thanks for joining us. And from Stephen Drennan and myself, Ben Jacobs, have yourself a good evening.